Rosie the Riveter built bombers there in World War II. Now Willow Run is on its way to a new era as a test center for self-driving vehicles.
The leaders from American Center for Mobility really envisioned this being the national playground, if you will, where all this testing will take place.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, keeping Michigan at the front of the mobility revolution. And later in the hour, how using zip codes nearly covered up the Flint water disaster. But first, Indiana Governor Mike Pence brings the campaign spotlight to Macomb County tonight. He's speaking at the Lincoln Day dinner in Shelby Township. Organizers say it's the largest crowd in recent memory for this event, and proof Macomb County is still very fertile ground for the GOP message and for Donald Trump. Here with us is Chad Silweski. He's a former longtime political reporter for the Macomb Daily, now a freelance writer and publisher of the blog Politically Speaking. So good to have you with us, Chad.
Good to be with you.
Politico has named Macomb County one of 25 battleground counties that need to be watched in this presidential race. Why is that?
Well, Macomb County is always a political battleground, at least going back to 84. When it became known as the home of the Reagan Democrats. It's always a toss-up county. It's always a county where elections are hard fought, to say the least. And this year is no exception. It's one of the real bright spots for Donald Trump in Michigan. One of the latest polls has Trump up 20 points in Macomb, even though he's losing statewide. And I suspect that Mike Pence is coming here to shore up that support, make sure it doesn't start to slip, and make sure that they have the third largest county in Michigan as an anchor for their attempt to win here.
Well, I'm curious about the mood among the Trump supporters right now in Macomb County. Are people responding to the Access Hollywood bus tape or the string of women who have come forward to accuse Trump of sexual misconduct?
Well, I think it's what you see across the country. Those who support Trump and believe in Trump do not think much of any of these latest charges. And those who support Hillary Clinton think that that should be the nail in the coffin for him.
So here we have this unwavering support in Macomb County, which I guess to understand, we need a history lesson of politics in Macomb County. Take us back to how the Reagan Democrats came to be such a strong force. I absolutely remember covering Ronald Reagan campaign events in Macomb County. Why was it such fertile ground for his message?
Well, I think it was not too different from what we're seeing in 2016, but with less anger. People had become disenchanted with the Democratic Party. They thought the Democratic Party had taken them for granted. And we're talking here mainly about blue-collar workers, working-class people, and they saw in Reagan somebody who was, kind of in a nostalgic way. He was like a very solid, good old-fashioned guy, very patriotic, didn't particularly like government programs as a solution to problems. And you're seeing a new version of that in Trump. It looked back several months ago that we would have actually like a wave of Trump Democrats. It's been hard to tell whether that's actually happening or not, but it is definitely a blue-collar, low to middle-income group of folks that are on the Trump bandwagon in a very big way.
Although, interestingly, now correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Barack Obama win Macomb County in 2008? I think I saw 53% to 45%.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise, toward the end you could see it coming. Over the years, Reagan Democrats became mostly Republican, and frankly, the Reagan Democrats of the mid-80s were similar to the Trump supporters. They were white people, tend to be 50 years old and up. So some of those Reagan Democrats from the past are no longer with us, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the demographics of Macomb County are changing, just like Oakland County next door. So we did have a run there where the Democrats were doing pretty well at the presidential level. And that is still up for grabs. I mean, you can't say that for certain heading into any presidential election these years that, well, Macomb County is definitely going Democrat or Republican. It's always, because we have so many ticket splitters, it's always a mystery what's going to happen in Macomb. And when that poll came out showing a 20-point lead for Trump, that really kind of baked in our reputation for being kind of maverick voters, contrarians, if you want.
I'm talking with Chad Selweski, who's a longtime political reporter in Macomb County, as we look at the strong support for Donald Trump in advance of Mike Pence speaking tonight at the Lincoln Day dinner in Shelby Township. Just what issues, Chad, do you think fuel Macomb County Republicans and the Democrats who are supporting Trump? What are the big issues that speak to them?
Well, obviously, one big issue is anti-Clinton way of thinking, that she would be a disaster. But in a more general sense, I think a lot of it has to do with not necessarily foreign policy or things of that matter, but just the basics about government finances, people just being fed up with welfare programs and failing schools and political correctness in our classrooms, immigration. Although that's kind of interesting because we have fairly minuscule level of legal immigrants, according to estimates, here in Michigan and Macomb County. But it's those things that Trump pounds away at, that the government can't do anything right, that we need to have an overhaul of the federal government, that they're wasting our money, taxes are too high, and if Clinton gets in, they'll go even higher.
And so the idea of... For example, the way that so many women are feeling about Mr. Trump after the last week or so, that does not seem to be swaying the support.
I don't quite see it that way. I think that the Trump support is so intense that there's really not much that could change that. I think that other things that have come up besides. Whether he paid his taxes, whether his foundation didn't act appropriately in terms of securing those funds. The Trump voter tends to just kind of push that aside and say, oh, well, that's the media or the elites or the establishment trying to knock him down a few pegs. It is quite possible that the 20-point lead is not there anymore because of what's been happening in the last 10 days. But another issue I forgot to mention is trade. Trade is a huge issue in Macomb County because we had so many people in this county living a very comfortable lifestyle due to factory jobs or jobs related to factory jobs, the spillover. And the trade message resonates really strongly here. And that's always a worry for the UAW. You know, they're obviously supporting Clinton to the T. And you hear a lot of anecdotes about factory workers, you know, just talking amongst themselves, and you'll have a whole group talking and like 9 out of 10 support Trump. So that certainly makes the unions a bit nervous.
Chad, we're talking about the voters. What about Republican officials in Macomb County? Are you hearing people worrying that Donald Trump could hurt down ballot Republicans come election day?
No, I actually in Macomb, from the best I can figure out, it's a situation that you have in a number of places across Michigan where Republican officials just don't want to talk about it. They don't want to abandon Trump. They're scared to death of a backlash from that, but they don't want to publicly say, oh, well, there's nothing to all this sexual harassment stuff. It's a bunch of nonsense, because then they run the risk of alienating a lot of female voters. So we haven't had a lot of officials, period, that are like very vocal Trump supporters, but they've been trying to kind of walk this fine line where, you know, don't dare say that you won't vote for Trump, but don't go out and be, you know, one of his big cheerleaders.
Chad Selweski, longtime political reporter in Macomb County, who is now a freelance writer and publisher of the blog Politically Speaking. Chad joined us via Skype. Always great talking with you, Chad. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Heads up, nature lovers. The Michigan Natural Resources Commission has added 5 amphibians and reptiles to its list of animals of special concern. And that means from here on out, it's illegal to trap, kill, or remove from their natural habitat mud puppies, pickerel frogs, fowler's toads, smooth green snakes, and butler garter snakes. The commission also changed some rules regarding bow and spear fishing. And there have been some rule changes for commercial fishing as well. The Natural Resources Commission is a division of the DNR, and it has exclusive authority to regulate the taking of game and sport fish in our state. Still to come, historic Willow Run Airport just east of Ypsilanti is transforming into a large-scale test center for self-driving vehicles. And then, what we can learn from the relationship between pandas and people when they live side by side.
150-60 pandas in the wild, and also there are about 5,000 local people inside the reserve.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
Start talking about Willow Run, and chances are pretty good images of Rosie the Riveter's building B-24 bombers in World War II will come to your mind. But there are big plans being cooked up to transform the old factory grounds near Ypsilanti into a highly advanced proving ground for autonomous and connected vehicles. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is here with more. Pete Bigelow spelling it all out in his story for Car and Driver. Good to see you, Pete. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me today.
Who's leading this push?
This is a group called the American Center for Mobility, a nonprofit organization based here in Michigan that wants to take this old brownfield site and turn it into something positive for the economy here.
And are they working with the state?
They are working very closely with the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, absolutely.
What's the vision?
The vision is that the auto industry of the past and present is rapidly changing. As many people notice, autonomous cars are not a thing of the distant future, but in advance that are coming here in the next 5 years, potentially.
Yes. I mean, they're all right there with skin in the game, and they want to see that in just a matter of a few years.
Absolutely. So this is a way for a nonprofit company to take all that work done by the automakers, by the suppliers, and kind of entrench the research and development portion of the auto industry here in Southeast Michigan.
We know last year the University of Michigan opened its M-City test track. How would this Willow Run test facility differ?
This is very different, and it's important to note that they potentially will complement each other very well when Willow Run opens. M-City's geared toward early stage testing, work with students, work with researchers, and it's really geared toward city environment testing. And Willow Run would be, once it's operational, sort of the opposite of all those things. In many cases, geared toward high-speed, highway-style testing, geared toward late-stage research where automakers could potentially also use the site to validate and self-certify their testing results and then put cars on public roads.
Not to get too cute, but almost like if you're baking the cake, then you get the ingredients kind of assembled at M-City, and then you bake and ice it over at Willow Run?
That's a perfect analogy, yes.
Huh. So working complementary, not competitively. How far along, then, is the planning?
It's in its early stages. I think it's something they've talked about for a lot of years, really put it together within the past 12 months. And now they foresee opening the first phase of this project potentially by the end of 2017.
And what would that be?
That would be a highway-style loop around the sort of outskirts of that 335-acre facility.
With that much space, you can go pretty fast.
Yes, and that's another major difference between M-City and Willow Run, potentially, is M-City, again, city-style testing maybe up to 45 miles an hour, probably not that much in reality. and then Willow Run potentially testing cars up to 80 miles an hour, trucks up to 60 miles an hour. So exactly that high-speed, highway-style environment that they're hoping to create.
And they've gotten funding, I understand, from the state to get this going?
They have. They've gotten a portion of the funding that they need. They've got the funding, $20 million so far, from the Michigan Strategic Fund to create and do the construction for that highway-style loop. So that's sort of the first phase. Then they have more ambitious plans coming after that that they're still working to secure the funding for.
What kind of plans? What's if they could wave that magic wand and make it happen, what else would it have?
It would involve a multi-lane intersection where they could potentially do some high-speed, high-risk scenario testing. It would involve a center for cybersecurity, which is a whole nother ball of wax here in this sort of, you know, fledgling autonomous car world. As the potential for cars to be hacked. They would have a potential use for drones and testing how drones can work in commercial trucking operations and unloading freight. There are a lot of different things that they could wind up testing within these 335 acres.
And this fits squarely with what the automakers have said, and we've also heard from other voices in Michigan, that they are not going to let Michigan lose its place in this race for autonomous and connected vehicles.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's interesting to me, covering this area, I've noted 2015 may have been the year where there was a lot of fear of losing it to Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. 2016... you've seen Google open a facility in Novi. Uber and Tesla have opened offices here. There's a whole lot of tech incubators that are opening in Detroit geared toward transportation. So I feel like 2016 is the year now where we're seeing a lot of that come back to the Detroit area.
And we're also seeing the automakers involved with Silicon Valley, because I'm getting a sense it's not either or, it's and.
Yes. You know, to go back to the word we used about these two facilities, complementary, I think really that... If you're an automaker or supplier, you need to be in both places. Both have their strengths, and together they can kind of bring this new era of transportation to fruition.
I think as people hear us talk about this, the idea of the testing that could happen if this Willow Run comes together under the American Center for Mobility, that's the stuff people want to know is good. When you hear stories of a guy in a Tesla going under a truck because he was letting it drive itself, we know that people hear that and they remember that. And I think people need a sense of how has it been tested, how secure is it? So this is the place, hopefully, where this can happen.
This is the place where the leaders from American Center for Mobility really envisioned this being the national playground, if you will, where all this testing will take place. And that's a great analogy, because Tesla has described its autopilot as a public beta. And clearly there's been an accident involving a fatality with that.
Yes.
So yes, this is hopefully a place where all that testing and validation comes together to make this a safe product as it reaches public roads.
So is it a given that this high-speed 2.5-mile test track is going to happen? They've got the money. It is going to happen?
Yes, that first phase is a given. They've got the money.
By when?
Hopefully construction starting early this spring. Optimistically, operational, that first part, by the end of 2017.
And considering we've heard from automakers that they want to see cars on the road by 2020, 2021, this is the time to be doing that.
This is exactly it. If you think of their development cycles taking typically, you know, a ballpark of 4 years, they can't build this high-speed loop fast enough.
Fascinating stuff, and very much worth keeping our eye on. Pete Bigelow with Car and Driver. Thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Oh, great to be here.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He has spent some two decades studying pandas and people in a remote corner of China. And that work by Jack Liu of Michigan State University is yielding powerful lessons in sustainability. Jack Liu is a human environment scientist and sustainability scholar at Michigan State, where he directs the Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability. Jack, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you began working in the Wolong Nature Reserve, and it's home to both giant pandas and people. And you started about 20 years ago. What brought you there, and what were you looking for?
The main reason was trying to understand how humans and their wildlife interact and how we could generate lessons for manage the wildlife and for both humans and nature to thrive.
Give us an idea of what's at the nature reserve. How many pandas? How many people?
Yeah, the nature reserve is for panda conservation. It was established in 1975. And besides about 10% of the wild pandas in the reserve, that's about 150-60 pandas in the wild. And also there are about 5,000 local people inside the reserve who depend on the forest and the land for their livelihood.
So it was a really great laboratory for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it's an excellent laboratory for studying coupled human and natural systems. By coupled human and natural system, we mean those systems which humans interact with the natural system and how the natural system will have impact on the humans as well.
So what were your early findings, Jack? And then from that, have your findings changed through the years?
Yeah, one of the early findings was very surprising because usually people expect that after an area is established as a nature reserve, the habitat for the pandas should get better. But what we found is the opposite. We found that the habitat for the pandas actually was getting worse faster than the reserve was established in 1975. Also, inside the reserve, the habitat was worse than outside of the reserve. So this was really surprising and unexpected for us as well in the beginning. And then we had to understand the reasons behind this unexpected results.
What did you come to understand? What were some of the reasons for those results?
What we found is that inside of the nature reserve, the human population size had been increasing a lot, actually by about 70%. Since the reserve was established. More importantly, the number of households has increased about 170%. Then if you have so many more people, so many more households, then they need more land, more forest, which happen to be habitat for the pandas. So they have to cut down the forest. That's a destruction for the panda habitat.
So these findings in your research, how has that work affected conservation policies in China?
Well, in the beginning, it was difficult because the government and even the conservation community did not believe the result because they said that's just impossible because they spend so much time, so much effort, so much resources to protect the habitat. And what we reported was so counterintuitive. And so they investigated, and then finally, after a number of months, they found our result was accurate. So from that time on, there was a big turning point change. So they asked us to find solutions to the problem. So we worked with the government and the local management and implement new policies and help people as well. So provide more conservation subsidies to the local people, and then the local people do not need to go to the forest and to go to the panda habitat to cut down the forest. People are happier, people live a better life, and then their habitat also has been recovering.
So what sounds like when you look at people and you look at nature, you've realized and proven it doesn't have to be either or, it can be and.
Yes, exactly. That's something that I think a really rewarding experience and change people's perception and also attitude towards conservation, because one of the main challenges is that the people there already for generations. The government may try to move people out, but the people could not move out or they don't want to move out. So what we propose is to really help the local people by providing subsidies to them in the long run. We're also trying to encourage the government to provide better education for the children of the local people so that they can get a higher education and then they can go to college, go to technical schools and find jobs in the cities and elsewhere so they don't rely on the nature reserve for the local resources anymore. That's really good for the people too.
There is a book out that looks into the work you've been doing. It's called Pandas and People, Coupling Human and Natural Systems for Sustainability. And in that book, there's discussion of telecoupling. So take us further. What is telecoupling?
Telecoupling is a new term, and which means the interactions, Social economic interaction and environment interactions take place across distance. So this nature reserve, for example, is in a remote area, but actually has a lot of interactions with the rest of the world, in the U.S., from Europe, and other parts of the world. And through a lot of things, like tourism, a lot of people from around the world visit the nature reserve. They go to the reserve to see the pandas, to see the local landscapes. Also, the local people produce agricultural products. They sell the product to the city people. That's another way of interaction between the local nature reserve and the people in the cities. There are many different types of interactions over distance. So that really gave us a new framework to understand how the world is getting smaller, how the interactions across different regions of the world are getting stronger, and how we consider those kind of stronger interactions in the management, in the people's livelihood, even in some remote areas of the world.
So with these lessons in sustainability that you've learned through your work, Jack, at the Wolong Nature Reserve, what do you believe telecoupling will mean ultimately for humankind and for our planet?
Yeah, I think it's very important. Telecoupling could have both positive or negative impact. So it's important to understand their consequences, both short-term and long-term, in different locations, not just in the nature reserve, but also in other parts of the world. I think that's very important for us to figure out how to manage the planet for the future and how to design new policies which could help people and help pandas and other wildlife species, and not just in China, but across the whole world.
Well, now that pandas, Jack, have been declared no longer endangered but vulnerable, what do you think your role has been in that, and where do you go from here?
I think our research results have helped to understand the interaction between people and the pandas and help improve the policy and the management. I think it's important that this kind of work continues, and we are very gratified that this positive change have taken place. But in the long run, there are many tasks ahead of us. One example is that global climate change is intensifying. We don't know what kind of impact this global climate change will have on the future of the pandas, especially on the bamboo, because bamboo is the main food source for the pandas. So if bamboo disappear after climate change takes place, then there is a serious consequences for sustainability of the pandas. So we are working on this new project to evaluate how climate change will have impact on the pandas, and hope the information will be useful for the government to develop long-term solutions and policies for conserve the pandas and help people in the decades or centuries to come.
It certainly seems like there are many challenges and much work for those who are going to come after you, for the students who are working with you now and future sustainability scholars.
Yes, they are. That's why we wrote that book, because the book is a synthesis of the work that we did in the past 2 decades. So the book has some good lessons that we learned, and we want to share those lessons with the young people and with other scientists as well, and also with the policymakers, so that we work together can help people and the future generations to manage the planet in a sustainable way. Also, I think the future provides a lot of opportunities for the younger generation to do interdisciplinary research, because one of the main lessons we learned is that to protect the pandas or other wildlife species, we need to understand how people respond to those policies and other government initiatives. So it's important to balance people's needs and the wildlife's needs. So if we want to protect the wildlife species, either panda bears or polar bears or other species, I think it's important to take people's needs into consideration.
You can read more about Jack Liu's work in the book Pandas and People, Coupling Human and Natural Systems, for Sustainability. Jack is the director of the Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability at Michigan State University. Jack, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thank you.
According to state numbers, there are nearly 7,500 female-headed farms in Michigan. Well, the USDA wants to encourage more. And why do zip codes and science not match up? That's up next on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is reaching out in a very special way to women and minority farmers and growers in Michigan. Just what's behind this focus on the non-traditional growers? And why did the USDA make its Michigan announcement last week in Flint? The administrator of the USDA Farm Service Agency spoke with us right after the announcement. Val Josini, welcome to Stateside and welcome to Michigan.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. It's always nice to push back from my desk in D.C. from time to time and visit our offices and customers all over the country.
Val, how would you describe the state of our nation's farming economy today?
Well, I think these are challenging times. You know, commodity prices have declined. The ag economy has softened somewhat around the nation. Natural disasters have affected various parts of the nation, whether it's wildfires or the floods that we've just seen on the Atlantic seaboard or drought in my home state of California. It's tough to be a farmer these days, and that's why the safety net programs that USDA is providing are really so essential. We completed a fiscal year just last week that saw us make over $6.3 billion in loans available to farmers and ranchers around the country, and that really speaks to a need for greater financial assistance and greater tools and services and programs for those men and women that grow our food, fuel, and fiber.
Looking at historic context, how different or how new are these challenges? Or are they all kind of part of, you know, what it is to be a rancher or a farmer, the long cycle in agriculture?
You know, I think they're part really of a great continuum of challenges that farmers see in their daily operations. I was just visiting a man that grows apples out in the Flushing area, and, you know, he's had some recent challenges with frost, for example, that reduced his yield significantly in the last couple of years. He's bounced back a little bit, but, you know, whether it's weather or whether it's declines in prices or whether it's invasive pests, you know, there are any number of things that impact the work that farmers and ranchers do out in the fields every day. Part of what I'm here to see in Michigan is to visit with new and beginning farmers and ranchers, farmers who are farming in an urban environment, and see what more we can do at the Department of Agriculture to make sure that we serve them as well as we serve the big commodity operations in the Midwest.
Well, so Val, you're in Flint to raise awareness of the kinds of programs you've got designed, especially to help these women and minority farmers and growers. So what kind of programs are we talking about?
You know, we really have a much more robust suite of programs. I think it's a more robust toolbox really now than we did even 4 or 5 years ago. We have microloans that are focused on small-scale operations. You may not need $300,000 or $400,000 when $10,000 would do to help buy a used piece of equipment or hire one or two more employees. We have conservation programs that really focus on things like high tunnel work around the nation. And so if you've got, you know, an urban area that you're farming, maybe two high tunnels can allow you to increase your production another 4 or 5 months into the winter. We have farm storage facility loans that allow you to store your produce on site and wait for better prices or better market opportunities. We've got a lot of different things that I think are more adapted to the needs of urban farmers and farmers that really have been traditionally underserved by USDA programs over the years. What I'm trying to do is bring farmers of color, returning veterans, women farmers, urban farmers, others into the fold that need to be able to take advantage of the safety net programs that have served more traditional operations so well since the days of the New Deal.
What would bringing in a more diverse farming population do for our agriculture industry?
You know, I think one of the great things that it does is simply raises awareness in urban areas like Flint. I was just chatting with some folks who are farming in the Detroit area, and we were talking about diet issues. So, you know, the rampant expansion of things like juvenile diabetes and obesity can really be remedied by more fruits and vegetables in the community. So, you know, these folks are growing kale and other greens, not just for farmers markets, but also for local preschools. And I think that if USDA is there to support men and women who are taking that plunge, and it is a real plunge, we'll all be better served. I was in New York earlier this summer visiting folks in the South Bronx, in Brooklyn, and in Queens. Urban agriculture is really something that's thriving in every great American city all across our country.
And is that what brings you to Flint? Is that why you've chosen Flint for your event and to unveil the awareness program?
That's certainly a big part of it. You know, Senator Stabenow has been a real leader on national agricultural issues, and she recently introduced an urban agriculture bill that I think has a lot of really great ideas in it, and it will be a continued part of the conversation as the Congress transitions into a new year and begins to talk in greater detail about what the next farm bill is going to look like. I think that urban agriculture has got to have a seat at the table to make sure that, you know, we're serving the folks who are farming in Detroit just as well as folks who are farming in other parts of the country.
What's the current congressional mood over the Farm Service Agency's lending programs? Are you getting enough support on the Hill that you're confident that, you know, these supports will continue or even expand?
I think that we are. You know, we periodically run short of money in our accounts from time to time, and the Congress is usually pretty good about providing us additional resources so that we can address the credit needs of farmers and ranchers all across the nation. You know, I oversee an agency that has about 2,200 offices from Maine to California. All of those offices obviously are going to be found in congressional districts for mostly rural members, suburban members as well. And so I think there's a great deal of support for the work that the Farm Service Agency and the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Rural Development Agency and all of my other sister agencies at USDA do every day, mostly anonymously, sometimes in an unheralded way, but we are really serving the men and women who serve all the rest of us. You know, we once were a nation that was largely rural and largely rural in its focus. Now only about 2% of Americans actually work the land and raise the crops and commodities that we enjoy here in America to create our safe and reliable and relatively inexpensive food supply, but that are exported to hundreds of countries all over the world. So I think the Congress sees us as a very vital part of that safety net that we provide for not just rural Americans and farmers and ranchers, but truly for all Americans.
Val, what is your message to, especially to new or beginning farmers and growers in Michigan?
Reach out to me. I really want to make sure that folks know that they're welcome in our offices, even if they live in urban areas. We've got a good website, usda.gov/newfarmers, that has all kinds of really important information about program opportunities. Chances are good that there's an FSA office not too far from where you're living. We have 50 offices here in the state of Michigan, and as I mentioned, hundreds of others around the nation. It's really important for urban farmers who are interested in learning a little bit more about our programs, about what loan opportunities may exist, or conservation grants, or value-added business grants, know that they can come to USDA, get their questions answered, and hopefully develop a relationship that builds their businesses and serves their communities.
Val Dossini is the administrator of the USDA's Farm Service Agency. Val, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was late September 2015 when the lid blew off the Flint water disaster. At the time, much of the attention, much of the credit, went to Virginia Tech water scientist Mark Edwards and Flint pediatrician Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha. Edwards had been issuing a steady flood of warnings based on his test of water from Flint homes. And Dr. Mona's study of blood lead levels in Flint's children finally convinced state officials a public health catastrophe had indeed occurred. But there is another player in all of this, and his analysis of Dr. Mona's medical study destroyed the state's contention that Flint's water problem was being overblown. Rick Sadler, Flint native and Michigan State University urban geographer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mona called you, Rick, in September 2015, where she'd been getting a lot of pushback from the state because its findings didn't support hers. What did she ask you to do?
Yeah, I had met Dr. Mona a few months before. We were doing some work on the pediatric clinic that we have here in town. And she called me up and said, hey, I have this blood lead data, and I need you to map it using your GIS analysis, so your geographic information systems work. And so I'm a geographer. I was trained in GIS at U of M Flint. And the long and short of it was she just wanted me to throw them on a map because she had only been able to look at the zip codes, not having that capacity to geocode them. And the problem is that our Flint zip codes don't match up at all with the city of Flint. And so when you're looking at a Flint zip code, you're including a bunch of people from all the townships and one of the cities that are outside of the city limits of Flint.
And that's what the state had been doing.
Yep. And so just making the assumption that, oh, if it says Flint 48507, it must be city of Flint. And so these are the kids we're dealing with. But the problem is that a third of that list actually includes kids who are outside the city limits and thus the water system of Flint.
Rick, as you put your analysis together, you did this spatial analysis.
Yep.
What were you thinking when you, put these maps together and realized, oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was trying to approach it purely as a scientific perspective and not put in any kind of passion, stay dispassionate to the issue and try and make sure that I got the science right without jumping to conclusions. But the outcome in Flint was so blatantly different from the outcome outside of the city. It didn't take me a lot of time to come over to the side that, yeah, there really is a problem. This really does validate what the residents of Flint and Mark Edwards' team and Mona had been saying for a long time.
You say that the state went wrong relying on zip codes for its analysis. And in your piece on theconversation.com, you call zip codes the bane of my existence as a geographer. Why is that, Rick?
Yeah, well, so I grew up in a city that had formed kind of after some of these zip codes were laid out. And so we had this little part of my city that was assigned a zip code to a neighboring city. So I had friends growing up who would kind of, say, oh, I live in such and such. And I'd say, well, but do you actually live in the city with me? We live in the same city. So it was just kind of frustrating, even as an adolescent, trying to show people this issue with different types of geographies and them not really being able to understand it because, they write on their mail, oh, I live in this city. Then becoming a professional within geography, we run into these types of issues all the time. And there's a name for it. It's called the modifiable aerial unit problem. And it's basically just the idea that if you cut a unit or an area up into different shapes of units, you're going to come up with different results. So if you're looking at access to healthy foods or crime rates or really, blood lead levels, you're going to come up with a different figure if you're looking at large areas or weirdly shaped areas or non-contiguous areas.
Well, does this really go back to when white settlers came into the indigenous areas and started carving up Michigan into their own arbitrary lines of townships and counties? Do we go back that far?
I don't think townships are quite as bad just because they are at least typically they're kind of square-shaped. They contain one coterminous area. I mean, I would say it goes back to maybe the 30s or 40s when the post office started assigning these postal routes. They were assigned based on what a postal carrier could do. And when our cities were cities and our country was country, you might do a segment of a city and kind of run out and do the 20 houses down the road and then come back and then that's your route for the day. And so the zip codes kind of grew out of those swaths. They're kind of like pie-shaped wedges of, in Flint anyways, pie-shaped wedges of the city. So it includes urban, suburban, and rural areas.
So in essence, just so because a lot of us are a little less scientifically and statistically bent, what the state got, let me see if I get this right, by using the zip codes was this watered-down analysis that was full of people who were not drinking Flint water.
For sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. And any one zip code includes a whole cross-section of people who live in, older urban neighborhoods and newer suburban areas and rural areas. And so you're lumping people who are very different from one another socioeconomically and in terms of their exposure to environmental pollution into the same unit.
Is this common across the country that a mistake like this that public health experts are making or environmental experts?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's kind of a gap between, and it's growing, it's kind of rebuilding itself, but there was a gap between the urban planning and geographical professions and the public health profession. And the advent of GIS or geographic information systems into urban planning and geography in the last 20 years has increased the tools at their disposal for analysis. But because there hasn't been good conversation between them and public health, it means that when public health moves into geographical type inquiries, they'll often rely on more simplistic conceptions of geography like zip codes or counties or something that doesn't have the same level of resolution.
And you touched on this, but take us in a little bit deeper that these fragmented urban regions based on zip codes, how are they masking public health disparities for poor and minority residents really everywhere?
If you are looking at the zip code level and the zip code includes people who are of higher socioeconomic status lumped in with people of lower socioeconomic status, you might wind up with a health statistic like, oh, the life expectancy is so many years. But if you really look at just the urban part of that zip code or the poorer part of that zip code, you might find that health disparities there are a lot greater. And so if we look across an urban region and we look at that, you know, kind of the zip code predicts your life expectancy kind of idea, there might be a variation between, you know, 70 years and 85 years. But if you cut it up into neighborhood units or some kind of smaller, more meaningful unit, you might actually find that life expectancy could vary between, you know, 60 and 85 years within an urban region because of the exacerbation of disparities within certain areas within those zip codes.
Well, then, Rick, what do you think, as an urban geographer, what needs to happen for public health and environmental officials, whether we're talking federal, state, or local, to not make this zip code mistake?
I think it's just being cognizant of limitations. So as geographers, we are naturally collaborative, and we work across many disciplinary lines because we need that expertise in other areas. And so vice versa, it's kind of a recognition that there are some things that are geographical in nature and require somebody with that kind of training and urban planning background to think about what are the built environmental and social variables that might impact that. And there are other tools at our disposal. You know, we even just census units, like census block groups, are a lot smaller, and they're more homogeneous in terms of their characteristics within their areas.
Do you and Dr. Mona ever stop and talk about just what might have happened if she had not brought you into this process? I mean, how much longer it might have taken the state to admit that she was right and they did have an all-out disaster on their hands?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, there was so much activism in the community that the work of Mark and Mona helped tip the scale. But I think that I hope that wouldn't have been a whole lot longer based on the activism going on. Something would have happened. But yeah, it is, I mean, it's something that we think about, and we're working on a paper right now that's looking at some of the relationships between certain events in time and changes in blood lead levels in kids. And so one of the things we're doing is to build a counterfactual and see what would have been the added burden in terms of exposure to lead in the water if, for instance, you know, some of the earlier events hadn't happened, some of the local media reporting, or if Mark and Mona hadn't come around, or, you know, if it had taken another 6 months for it to blow the lid off. Those are some of the things that we're going to be looking at in a couple upcoming papers.
Well, we'll have to talk with you when those come out then. We'll very much look forward to that.
For sure.
Michigan State University urban geographer and Flint native Rick Sadler. You'll find his piece, How Zip Codes Nearly Mask the Lead Problem in Flint, at theconversation.com. Rick, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's show is directed by Mike Blank, and our engineer was Rusty Brock. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.